Hi, welcome back to Bookish. My guest this week is the novelist John Burnham Schwartz. I was lucky enough to meet him because my great friend Nancy Baker Cahill, who is an upcoming guest. Nancy is not only a great friend, but one of the best connected people I know, meaning she just knows the best people. And I have her to thank for my introduction to Danzy Senna, who was earlier on this podcast, and not only her, but also Barbara Bester, the architect we heard from last week, and now from John Burnham Schwartz. So Nancy is the unacknowledged producer of this season's show. She was kind enough to lend us her dining room while John was in LA for a few days, and he and I sat and talked about the novels that have shaped him. It was really interesting. He's incredibly well-read and thoughtful, beautiful writer. His first novel, Bicycle Days, was a sort of semi-autobiographical novel about the time he spent studying in Japan as a young man straight out of Harvard. And it's a glorious, very gentle, thoughtful, but insightful book about being a young man in a completely alien culture and sort of finding oneself in this strange space and figuring out who you are while you're away. I found it very moving, that book. And he's written other novels too. He wrote a book called Reservation Road, and co-wrote The Wizard of Lies, the HBO movie about the disgraced financier Bernie Madoff. He's contributed articles to The New Yorker, The New York Times Book Review, Boston Globe, and Vogue. And he is also the literary director of the Sun Valley Writers Conference. So it seems there's not a writer he doesn't know. And he's also been very generous in introducing me to future guests for the podcast. Here's the interview with John.
John, thank you so much for agreeing to do it.
It's so lovely
of you. I really appreciate it.
Any time to talk about books.
You do. Have you always been a reader? Were you a reader since you were a little kid?
I have been, yeah. I mean, I grew up, we had a lot of writers around. So my father was a lawyer he's been out in Los Angeles for 35 years and moved more into film and TV. Mm. But back then it was writers, painters, actors, playwrights.
Wow, what a household.
Truman Capote was in our house all the time. Arthur Miller.
Really?
All the time.
Because he was their lawyer?
Yes. And the Millers would spend weeks with us. I grew up with Rebecca, you know, Arthur's daughter.
Wow. Right, yeah.
My father represented. David Halberstam was my godfather.
Wow.
Peter Schaffer was my other godfather.
Oh, my goodness.
He was in the hospital when I was born.
Oh, my goodness.
And on and on. I mean, my father represented Solzhenitsyn for a while,
okay.
Tennessee Williams.
Oh, wow.
For a little while. And then gradually got more away from the arts. There were some great painters too. And,
mm-hmm.
Richard Avedon was a photographer. And so that was the culture we were sort of growing up in.
Was your mom a
she ended up, you know, she loved literature, and she ended up in her second half of her life marrying W.S. Merwin, the poet.
Oh, my goodness.
Who's my stepfather.
Oh,
and
right.
So my mom passed away last spring, but William is still, he's 90 and a half.
Wow.
Not writing anymore,
okay.
But really truly remarkable man, but also a remarkable poet.
Wow.
So I met him when I was 15.
Oh, right.
And so there were all these different things. At the same time, I was coming out of college, I was going to be a banker.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read Bicycle Days, which
right.
I absolutely loved. I'm
it's probably fresher in your mind than it is
probably,
in mine.
Probably is. I was just so struck that could be written. I mean, I read about it and read it was published on your 24th birthday.
It was. I remember walking down 7th Avenue with two of my friends late the night before. In other words, just as the papers, boy, this really dates all of us. The papers were delivered to the newsstand.
Uh-huh.
And we'd been out drinking, and so I bought it, and there was my first review from the Times. And, you know, it was a really nice review.
Yeah, it was a lovely review. I read it.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful book. It's
thank
an
you.
Absolutely beautiful book. It's so, the prose is so lucid and so, what's the word? I think steady. Just, I was just so astonished that a 24-year-old, well, you were a 23-year-old.
I was 21 when I started.
When you wrote it.
Yeah.
And it's the, just to fill in readers, it's the story of a young man who's just left college and goes to Japan to be ostensibly a banker, right?
I mean, all very thinly disguised, but I mean, I made him from Yale instead of from Harvard and that sort of thing. Yes, he goes off and with a kind of, personal fantasy, I think, of becoming another person in another place. The idea, you know, that you can remake yourself in some fashion, which of course suggests that the person he really is not someone he either knows or particularly cares for.
Right. And also that sort of heartbreaking maxim, which is a fridge magnet virtually, but wherever you go, there you are. So
magnets are very...
They're fridge magnets for a reason.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. It's also Buckaroo Banzai in the eighth dimension, that movie with Peter Weller. It's a cult movie.
Okay.
And it's wherever you go, there you are. It's
right.
Sort of the mantra.
Right, yeah. Okay. But I was struck by the maturity, but also by the loneliness of it. I found it a very lonely book. There seems something very isolated about this boy. And even when his brother comes, the sort of disconnect there.
Mm-hmm.
It took me back to my early 20s, mm-hmm. and that feeling of being utterly lost. I left Oxford at 21 and knew I wanted to act and had an agent, which was great and was already a step above, you know, many. But being so bewildered by the lack of structure that was going to help me forward, that I'd been through these rigorous, as had you, sort of academic hierarchies that had prepared me for the next stage at every level. And then you're erupted out of university and nobody and nothing prepares you for the free
fall that actually have no sense becomes
nothing at all, and nothing. And maybe this is particularly true of acting, and maybe more true of banking and places that have more of a hierarchy, but nothing prepared me for the fact that the maxim of how, if you work hard, you'll get results,
mm-hmm.
no longer applies in the real world. It has been true for the whole of school. If I worked hard and put the hours in, I could get the grades, I could get, you know, the A's or get into Oxford or do whatever it was. But suddenly I could be delivering the best auditions in the world and still not land the job. I just wasn't right for the part. And that was, and continues to be, age 43, baffling to me. I actually think
that's about acting. I think that's a kind of brutal back and forth that I find more brutal in some ways than mm-hmm. writing. Each form mm-hmm. has its own traumas. But, I mean, I've been on the other side of the casting thing a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And someone walks in and you're like, thank you, because somehow immediately you had something else in mind.
Yes.
And I think that it goes against, I mean, especially when you get into something at an age where you feel somehow that your own freedom is yoked to doing this
mm-hmm.
thing and your own fulfillment. And at the same time,
your identity.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you understand that it's something without a solid ground and it's never going to have a solid ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to accept. My father is turning 85 on Tuesday.
Mm.
He's been a lawyer his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
He can't retire. I mean, he said to me the other month, he lives out here, and he said, you know, my whole identity is bound up in this thing. But this thing is something that exists. It has an office.
Right.
It has a set of rules and a particular set of hurdles that you have to, you know, attend to and get over. The other ones don't. I mean, what I do, what you do, is something that the hurdles oftentimes never existed except in your own mind.
Right.
And then there are other hurdles that you never conceived of because you saw something a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm about to hand in my sixth novel.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We'll see. I mean,
let's take it
very close. Thank you.
Finishing it alone, that's an achievement.
Very close.
What's it called?
It's called An Elegy for Exile,
uh-huh.
and it's inspired by the life of Stalin's daughter.
Oh, wow.
And
where was she exiled?
She defected to America in 1967.
Really?
It was the biggest defection of the Cold War.
Uh-huh.
I guess Nureyev was close.
Right.
And she had been Stalin's beloved child mm-hmm. and daughter when he was young. Her mother killed herself mm-hmm. when she was six. But she left two children, older children, in Russia, defected somewhat spontaneously, came to America, and then lived a life that, as the Times obituary said when she died in 2011, reads like a Russian novel.
Wow.
And it is. It's absolutely a crazy life that involves defecting back years later to the Soviet Union with a 13-year-old American child
mm-hmm.
in tow, then defecting back to England
wow.
and ending up dying in obscurity in an assisted living place near Spring Green, Wisconsin, near Taliesin, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's place, where she had lived, and that's where her child was born. She had married into that crazy family.
She married into the Lloyd Wright's
one. Yes, so all sorts of things.
And never is it a biography or is it a novel?
It's a novel, absolutely. Yeah. No, I read there's a pretty good biography of her post a few years ago. And I was looking forward to reading it, and I grabbed whatever I wanted out of it. And it was well done. But I felt, having read so many of Svetlana's letters and all of her things she'd written, my father had a lifetime of letters from her because he, in fact, was the young lawyer at 34 who went over and brought her over when she defected. He went over under CIA cover in the middle of the night under an assumed name, met her. They had fake passports, brought her back on the plane. And when they arrived, the news had gotten out during the flight. And there were more reporters than there were for the Beatles 4 years before.
What a great story.
So I knew her when I was tiny. She was in our house off. And so anyway, I hadn't thought of her till she died. Then I read about her, and then I just started thinking. But all to say, how did I get into that?
Because we were talking about structure and not having it, and work and finishing things. And
yes.
Yes.
So that's my sixth. That'll be my sixth published novel. Mm-hmm. But there were two others, of course. That I mean, everybody has some version of this. But I spent more than 2 years on each of them. One in my 20s after my first novel, and then another one in my mid 30s, where everything, of course, the stakes just keep getting higher.
Sure.
You're married by then, thinking of having children, and
so two novels that never made it.
Never made it. Never finished. Never properly finished them. Never got any money for them. Never got anything. Just writing, you know, hundreds of pages.
And is the DNA of any of those buried in the DNA of future ones?
I mean, I believe intrinsically, yes.
Yes.
I mean, I know with the second one that I put aside, it was right before I wrote The Commoner, which was my fourth novel. And the book I'd been working on was set in the 70s, involved black characters and white characters, New York City, urban. Once again, most of the things that are closer to my own life like that end up falling by the wayside. I'm just not that interested, really. But I ended up moving directly from that into the story told in the first person by a fictional Japanese empress over the course of 70 years of her life.
I can't wait to read that.
And I've been
when I read about it, it just sounded
so
glorious.
It was a wonderful project to work on. And I was a Japanese studies major in college. Mm-hmm. So moving that quickly from one completely different world and voice to another seems almost reckless. Mm-hmm. And then meanwhile, during the time I'm 3 years, I'm writing The Commoner, sitting in the corner like a piece of kryptonite of my study every day is this enormous, you know, half foot of paper that I never look at.
Right.
And after I finished The Commoner, I went back and I reread that manuscript. Mm-hmm. And by then, you know, I could see it so much more clearly.
Right.
I could see that about a third of it was, you know, not good enough, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, not up to my standards in any way.
Sure.
A third of it was okay, which is also not good enough. And a third of it was actually, you know, quite good.
Right.
And I could see what I felt it needed.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't that person anymore.
Right. Oh, interesting.
I had outgrown it.
Right.
My interest. And so, you know, I think as you...
That's wonderful. That sounds wonderful.
It is. I mean, I never regretted it because it got me to the book I needed to write.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, the DNA is, well, it's a form of transition or an inheritance of some kind because you needed to do that. I mean, look, love is not that dissimilar in certain ways in terms of you don't regret the things that got you to where.
No.
Where you are.
You don't. It's true. There's some parallel with acting, I suppose. I think, you know, I audition or read scripts or go for meetings with people. And first of all, there's a really basic truth, which is you just never know, even the jobs that you don't get, whether you've left a lasting impression that means someone hires you. That's happened to me. I can think of at least 5 times that I have gone on years later to book a gig with someone who remembered me from a previous thing or who'd almost cast me, which I didn't know about at the time. So there's a sort of practical element, but there is also something in me that goes, you know, acting is one of the few disciplines that you can't really do on your own. It requires an audience. A musician gets to practice alone. A ballerina can work on her steps.
A writer can sit in a room.
In a room. As an actor, you need to be seen. Mm-hmm. You have to be heard. And that's heartbreaking unless you choose to see every audition as I try to, or mm-hmm. tape, or, you know, meeting and things, as the opportunity to literally
to
practice my steps.
Yeah. And to be seen and do it. Do it live,
yeah,
as they say. So,
exactly, yeah. And see it rather than one of my tactics is to go into every audition as though it were a rehearsal mm-hmm. rather than an audition. So I will go in and try things out, and that you happen to be watching me is great because mm-hmm. it gives me the stage to do it. But it's not me showing off. It's not me trying to win anything from you. It's me showing you. Or rather practicing what I do with an audience. And that
Have you ever had a case where you've done a show or a film, and even if the director, they all seemed happy with it, you felt that you had just never gotten it?
Oh.
And so, but it's sitting there now. It's out there because they took it from you.
Mm.
And what do you do with that?
I don't watch my work.
Yes, well, I do. I'm in agreement with you. I'm in general agreement with you about the relationship one has.
I don't really. Yeah. I really don't. And then I have to every now and then for sort of quality control mm-hmm. purposes.
Yes.
But then I try and leave enough time. If I watch something very soon after I've done it, I usually am in a ball of cringing shame. I can't handle it at mm-hmm. all. I barely listen to this podcast because I find it sort of unbearable. And yet I so love doing them that I have to let my producer take them away and edit mm-hmm. them. And then once they've been edited and I've done all 12, season one we did 12, and I'm hoping for 12 again this year, then I'll go and listen to them at a batch and I just push through and you know.
Well, there's a ruthless, practical side to doing these things if you want to do them.
Yeah.
And you have to have another voice in your head.
Right.
That's not personal.
Exactly. That just stands at the back of the cave and goes,
yeah. Here's, and that actually takes a long time to develop.
I think so. I think it's something I definitely didn't have in my 20s.
No.
Let's talk about your first book. I have, in the order in which you sent them to me, I have The Good Soldier as first. Does that work for you?
It does, actually. I, that remains for me, especially just as a novelist, it remains for me one of the most important novels, you know. I mean, it's always been top five for me.
I was so delighted to see it on the list. It was very close. I had my producer interview me for the final episode of season
one.
They were Where the Wild Things Are.
Yes.
A little tiny unknown cookbook that I...
Really?
Yeah, that I cooked from a ton as a little girl. Portrait of a Lady, Last Night by James Salter.
Oh, my goodness.
And Revolutionary Road. So those were mine. But Ford, Maddox Ford and The Good Soldier The Good Soldier was, I would say, number six. It was so close to being on the
list. It's funny you mentioned Salter. I was pitching is the only operative word at a meeting yesterday, his first novel, The Hunters.
Oh, really?
Which is just, I mean, I still remember being on a subway in the 90s reading this book for the first time.
Oh,
and
really?
I grew up with Jim.
Did you?
Yeah, I knew him very well. And he was a friend of my dad's and a client. And
he was wonderful.
It's amazing. And
he gave me the rights himself in person.
Did he?
Yeah.
He was a charming,
glorious man.
But, you know, I almost put Light Years on
Did
you?
Yeah,
yeah. Which is one of
so
the best
beautiful.
Books about marriage.
Ever.
Devastating.
Book. Ever.
Devastating. Doesn't make you necessarily want to
No,
go
but the
running
best books
the,
don't.
Yes.
The best ones don't.
It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Incredible writer.
Extraordinary writer. But no, Good Soldier, I was just... So Good Soldier is by Ford Maddox Ford. It was published in 1915. It is, just to sort of fill people who might not know the book, it is ostensibly a story about two couples who meet in... where do they meet? Baden-Baden? No.
It's a sort of watering
it's a
hole.
It's a watering hole, right?
And in a way, the name means nothing because
exactly.
it could be any.
It could be
place.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
And they're an English couple who are John Dowell and Florence, who Florence is the ailing one with a fading heart. And then Captain Edward Ashburnham and Leonora. And I'm sorry, I have that the wrong way around.
No, that's right.
Oh, that is
yes.
right. Yeah,
and Ashburnham is the quote. The good soldier, the title.
Exactly.
Although the book was originally named The Saddest Story.
The Saddest Story, but the editor told him to change it.
And he always regretted it, though. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, what was it, Trimalchio from West Egg for The Great Gatsby. I mean, let's just leave the title to the professionals.
Yeah, that's true.
I think they definitely got it right.
Yeah, I think so.
But I mean, in a way, the thing about that book, and I think one of the reasons why it's such a touchstone for so many people, novelists, but also people in the arts generally, is that it lives entirely, despite what it claims that it's doing, it lives entirely in the realm of the ambiguous, where nothing is exactly what you say. And so all of the suppressed motivations of the narrator, John Dowell, and all of the things about the society of these four people, for everything that he states, he's implicitly or explicitly stating the opposite. I mean, he talks about Ashburnham's blue eyes and how handsome he is. So there was, you know, they were so blue and so handsome, and they could, and at times they were perfectly, perfectly stupid. And I mean, and he keeps talking about how good he is, and there are words like nice, which is a definite killer in the book. But every single aspect of that, including the four of them, and how they, over 9 or 10 years, you know, see each other never in their own home places, where, you know, the Dowells are American, but not really like Americans. First of all, they're from Philadelphia, where he tells you there are more English, old English families than in half of England.
Yeah.
So they're not really Americans. And then these are the best kind of English people, perfectly English sort of, but in fact they're not, you know, neither the Ashburnhams really are.
Right.
And so everything, the whole way of telling it, he's constantly sort of twisting around this, and you begin to understand that that's as much of the story. I mean, you can give the story away, he gives it away.
Yes, you can give the story, but it's you're totally right, it's not about it's not about the plot, and the plot's pretty sensational. I mean, the plot is not nothing, but the telling and the retelling of it in a way that you, as of when you read it for the first time, I sort of wish I could read The Good Soldier for the first time again. Because
I feel that way about a lot of books.
My experience of it was so, I just remember thinking, this is one of the most modern things I've ever read. I can't believe this was written in 1915. This man is insisting that we revisit this event that we've already visited. And what is he bringing to it? And suddenly realizing, oh, he's giving me another detail that contradicts everything we already had about this incident that we've had. And this detail is making me see it not in direct contradiction, but it's adding something and it's taking something away, as you say, with the perfectly, perfectly stupid eyes. There's always something being layered in and something being gently removed that means it's not just an unreliable narrator. It's this absolutely shifting sense of consciousness that's being created on the page. That's, you know, Henry James was doing it completely differently with these long, languid, elaborate sentences that take you into sort of a beehive of the mind. And I feel like Ford Madox Ford is doing it with us and our endlessly shifting impressions of a room, a person, how our impressions of a human being change as we get to know them more.
Which is why it feels so contemporary, because in an age where, I mean, look, you can even go back to George W. Bush's presidency, where, you know, goodies and baddies and everything. I mean, that already feels archaic.
Right?
I mean, even at the time, we weren't very happy with it, some of us. But it feels now, it just feels utterly antiquated to see the world in this way. Yeah. It's impossible. And, you know, from the point of view of art, I mean, the gray area is where most of it lives. I mean, and even if, I mean, the notion of good being a sort of moral, a kind of conventional moral
value that we're going to hold on to,
and yet at the same time, you know, who owns that value?
Right.
And what is it? And the story itself resides in the fact that, you know, there is no constant that will tell you who is good and who's not. At the same time, you can see almost every time someone's referred to as good, they're not.
It's a red flag immediately. Yeah. How old were you when you read it?
I must have read it when I was 22.
In Japan?
Actually, I probably 24, because when I was 21, I spent about 5 months in Japan. I was 20. I guess it was 2021. And then I came back went to my senior year, I started Bicycle Days as a thesis. It was only 100 pages by the end of that. And then I moved to London while I was finishing that. I never got to Paris that time, where I thought I was going. And then after the book came out, I went there. And I mentioned all that just because I had been in Japanese studies major, as I mentioned, not an English major. And so though I had read a lot, there was a lot I hadn't read. And for basically 2 years while I was in Paris working on some very bad fiction, which will never see the light of day, and slowly, gracefully cracking up, maybe not so gracefully, I read. I just read. I read all the great French novelists. I read the great Russian writers. I read Cervantes. I read I read the Bible, which I was not very familiar with, just as literature, really. And so I read Ford Madox Ford then, too. I read the Modernists. You know, I mean, some of the stuff I had read before, but there were huge gaps. And that's probably still remains the most potent reading period of my life and definitely set me forth in how I read afterwards.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you read your next book, The Short Stories of Anton Chekhov?
I did read Chekhov then.
You read that then?
Yes, I did.
And you're of course, you have got The Short Stories of Anton Chekhov.
Period. No particular
volume. Right, exactly. And I stared at that and, you know, I've read them too, but I say read them. I've read the ones we've all read. He wrote
Lady
over
with,
400.
Lady with a Lap Dog. I mean, is, you know, there are, I mean, there are a lot of classic Chekhov stories. Lady with a Lap Dog is the most famous.
Yes.
And that's the one I've read the most, probably a dozen times.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And, you know, Gusev is another one. There are little ones like A Student. I mean, just 2 pages long. And then there are some longer ones. The Steppe, you know, is long. What's it? Ward 69. So, but, you know, the best thing you can do is just pick your best version of the best assorted. They all, after his early period, which the stories were shorter and more humorous, and I think he felt he wasn't very happy.
He wasn't as proud of them, yeah.
I think this, you know, the aspects of him, of his writing and his own humanity that we came to recognize, you know, became fully mature. And Lady with the Lap Dog is a sort of classic example where he takes a sort of conventional story of, you know, an older, sort of middle-aged married man and a woman who's, you know, married, nobody particularly happily, in a seaside resort town, and they begin an affair. And but what the story is really about is it's about a womanizer who actually falls in love. So it's about a fundamental change, but it's not done in the way that many stories do it, which is in a sort of epiphany-like moment where there's a direct and utter, you know, event that's the change itself.
Sure.
The change in him is a state of feeling, which then, rather than actually bringing forth the sort of happy ending that many people would imagine, actually throws him into a state of deep and almost haunted uncertainty.
Which seems about the standard state for Chekhovian characters, I feel like.
No,
there's that
is.
Beautiful moment in it where after they've had sex, he sits down and instead of talking to her or commenting on
cuts
it, or reaching it, he cuts and has a slice
That's
of watermelon.
Right.
It's
a famous moment.
Such a beautiful moment.
Yeah. And doesn't say a word.
No, it's just such a, and again, it's such a modern moment in you know, in what's otherwise a fairly predictable era, you think.
But it's so like life. I mean, so many of the things that on paper make better drama, in which are sort of clearly defined moments in which something happens, which then changes the state of feeling in someone and then changes the state of life. It's not exactly lifelike. I mean, so much of life is actually big things laced with little mundane, almost trivial
moments
of observation or perception or incident.
Is that why he was formative for you, do you think, as a writer? Was he for that? Was there something about...
I think, you know, look, his compassion is, you know, it's a word that's thrown around too often, but the compassion he has for all of his characters. And, I mean, he did have a very fundamental idea that the artist's job is not to put forth any kind of prescription, right. but to Manifesto, put forth a yeah. presentation.
Right.
It's how you present mm-hmm. your characters and what you have to say. And as such, he didn't judge. Mm. He had a way of making the ordinary strange mm. so that we were seeing it for the first time. I know I can't remember which story it's from, but remember once that he was describing a bird in a tree, and it's the person who looks at it. So it's not the author describing it. So he mentions the peasant who's walking underneath and then looking up, and it looks like a glove lying on it. You know, he describes it as a glove on a branch.
Right.
Completely bizarre. And yet it absolutely, you see it the way that person must have seen it. Glancing up.
Yeah.
And so it immediately throws you out of the ordinary into this moment. And I mean, his belief in the ability of the trivial and the mundane to sort of, in a weird way, make life more present mm-hmm. was captured. Raymond Carver, at the very, I think the last story he wrote was called Errand. Mm-hmm. And he was obsessed with Chekhov too, despite how different his stories are. And that story was a story of Chekhov's death. Hmm. And it's told from the waiter, the boy who comes in to deliver the champagne that's been asked, that Chekhov has asked for.
Yes.
And there's a moth or a bee that's in the room. And there are just all these little tiny details.
Yeah.
So you're seeing it from the waiter's eye. And,
yeah.
and in that way, it's not as good a story as a Chekhov story, but it's totally Chekhov.
An homage to it.
Yeah.
Because that was those were his last words, where I haven't had champagne
yes,
in a long time.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I mean, there was incredible consistency to making art that intended not to be artful, and yet in every way allowed for the sort of movement of life mm-hmm. to be, you know, to be the prize at the end. That's mm-hmm. that's the goal. That's mm-hmm. where most of these things go.
Right.
They just keep going. They're perceptions that keep opening out in apparently simple descriptions. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't waste a lot of time with emotional descriptions.
No.
Very little, very yeah. spare.
Yeah.
And yet you're constantly, without even knowing it, put in the minds and shoes of ordinary people of all sorts.
Yeah.
Who are not all good and not all bad. I
right.
mean, and through that, he works through a number of things that he absolutely abhorred in life, like violence and other things. But so in every case, there's sort of wonder and horror.
Mm. But they're always muted, I think. There's nothing sensational about what
Never.
He's doing. And I found this wonderful quote that Nabokov said of him. He described his prose as a tint between the color of an old fence and that of a low cloud. And I think from Nabokov, whose prose style was as far from that as it's possible to be, that was probably
recently. Yeah.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably sort of faint praise, but I thought that's as usual. He's actually nailed it. That is exactly where he is.
Mm-hmm.
His color. That is where he was aspiring to.
He
was to do, was to
pleased.
Render the old fence
yeah.
and the low cloud, because they're important and as important as the heartbreak that's going on, as important as the desertion or the abandonment or the whatever else. They're all there, they're all equal, and it's part of that, what you were saying, that much maligned word compassion, is his refusal, I think, to judge about what's important in a scene. It's
mm-hmm.
all, it all belongs.
That's what, everything's given equal weight.
Yeah.
And it's almost to such a degree, and you have to remember when he was writing it,
it's
incredible.
Yeah.
But to such a degree that actually it feels, again, it feels strange and almost radical.
Mm.
And because it's a shift for us to also say all of these things are equal and there's no particular end.
Mm.
The stories tend to just end.
Yeah.
You know, they go on. I mean, in Gusev, in the story Gusev, at the end he dies. He's wrapped up in this cloth bag in which Chekhov describes him. It's like a carrot or a shrub, you know, narrow at the top and wider at, or
a radish.
Yes, a radish,
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the body, he follows the body completely unexpectedly down into the water
mm.
as it's tossed over, past a pilot fish, and then as he goes down, and then he rises up again into it, and he describes the sky in this very simple but completely unexpected way with mm-hmm. no sort of missing a chunk of cloud or something. Yeah. And that's where he leaves you.
Right.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Do you do that with your novels? Do you leave? Do you tie them up? Do
you, well, you know how walk hard, out of the room and leave them? You know how hard it is to finish a novel. I mean, I would say I've rewritten the ending. I know Reservation Road, I rewrote the ending probably 30 times.
Did you?
And then in some cases, I'll end up writing past where I eventually end.
Interesting, right.
Because you realize you've gone too far.
Uh-huh, that's interesting.
That happens. I just did that again.
Did you?
Actually, yeah. So I just think you're looking for a place, you know, to end it in some way that expresses the basic feeling of why you wrote it.
Sure.
Which may be quite some time ago and not be apparent to anybody
sure.
else.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a hard thing to do, and you just keep looking at it all the way. But I'm more in favor of open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sensibility that Chekhov brings, it seems to me, is more lifelike
mm-hmm.
than anything
sure.
anything else. And, of course, there are some writers. I mean, Alice Munro is sort of famously mm-hmm. compared, although she's, you know, she began taking some of that strangeness and extrapolating it into almost a fantastical quality mm-hmm. in some of her late stories, mm-hmm. which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those stories seem to aspire to be read almost like novels,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that I don't think Chekhov really did.
Do you aspire to a short story?
I don't really.
Mm-hmm.
It's odd. I probably, if I was better at them, I'm sure I would. You know, it's
yeah.
like, I mean, we tend to have our aspirations shaped by
our failures. Yes, our failures. Yeah, sure.
But no, you know, I never went to an MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
The formative writing class I took at college was a poetry writing workshop with Seamus Heaney.
That'll do.
Wow. Yeah. And I was no poet, but it was fantastic.
Oh, my God. Just to sit in the room. How
right.
amazing.
Oh, I loved Seamus.
I bet.
He was wonderful.
What a voice.
Wonderful. So, I mean, he would come in, you know, pink-cheeked from the pub in the afternoon on a wintry day.
Perfect.
But, yeah, no, I deeply appreciate short stories.
Mm.
And I was just reading Lincoln and the Bardo, which made me go back to some of Saunders's short stories.
They're extraordinary. They're just extraordinary.
Yeah. And you have to think, especially since Lincoln the Bardo is not really a novel. It's a fascinating book.
But I agree. I have it as an audio book.
Yeah.
It's sort of thriving.
Well, it's more like a play. People say film script, but it's not. It's really more
like a play. It's a radio play.
Thornton Wilder.
I'm telling you, you should listen to the audio book.
I bet it is a radio play.
It's really extraordinary. And it's been cast with real actors playing.
I would love to do that.
Audible has it. It's wonderful.
But, you know, I go back to the stories and it's incredibly hard to do it. And I grew up reading a lot of it, but it's not, for some reason, it's just not that kind of enforced compression, although I don't think I write particularly long, you know, I'm more attracted to the scale of poetry in that sense than I am to the short story.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think not having ever written a story that I really think is
right.
at a level that you know I would admire, that probably has something to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, chicken and egg.
Yeah. I did a short story course here when I first came here.
Who was the
teacher? It was at UCLA, and it was I just was looking around. I think I was desperately homesick, if I'm honest. I was just homesick for England. And then UCLA campus felt not like Oxford, and yet somehow that there would be something for me there that would feel like home. And so I just signed up for any course I could. So I did a bunch of short story courses there. To my shame, I forget who I was taught by.
Yeah.
No one remarkable, except that they sent me off to read a whole bunch of short stories. And for that, I'm eternally grateful.
That's the great value.
Because my college degree had not encouraged that. So I only found Chekhov's short stories when I was 24, I think, 25.
There's something to be said for that always. I mean, coming to a book, I still have books on my shelves that it's like they've just been waiting there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and you pass by them again and again. And at some point, if you're lucky, you'll pull it down just when you need to.
Right. It's
you know,
so true.
Yes.
But there's also, we talk a lot about this on the podcast, the act of rereading and what that is, mm-hmm. and finding things, you know, rediscovering not just the novel, but who you are now in the context of this novel and who you were when you read it for the first time. And what an extraordinary experience that is. There isn't really anything else that I can think of that asks you to try on the same suit in the same way.
No, watching a film again is not the same.
It's not the
you
same.
Know, you can watch
no, and you're not,
20 years later,
your emotional and inner world isn't engaging mm-hmm. with it for the same length of time that a novel asks you to.
Well, you have to be inside it also.
Yeah.
That's what reading is. I mean, the book is not finished when you finish it.
No.
The book is completed by the reader.
Right.
And so until that happens in its own way, it's not quite done.
Talk to me about your third book. You have, again, you cheated hugely by picking a trilogy, the Regeneration trilogy by Pat Barker, which was published Regeneration was 1991, The Eye and the Door was 1993, and The Ghost Road was 1995. I had read Regeneration when it came out and was astonished by it,
mm-hmm.
really astonished.
I remember that's when I read it, and I remember that experience.
Yeah, and then I don't remember The Eye and the Door, and I do remember The Ghost Road. So
fill
me in why...
You're right. The Eye and the Door actually is a slightly less accomplished book. It's the trilogy. I think the trilogy matters because... First, let me say, I think she's a remarkable writer. She's not one of my favorite writers in the world.
But I asked performative, not favorite,
yes,
so I'm really glad you made the distinction.
And I'm just finishing the second of my novels that... is historically based.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, quite in this case, very much taking real lives and then inventing certain people and mixing real people and other people. I'm certainly not the first person to do it, but the impact of what she did and how she set about telling those stories.
So again, just for the listener that doesn't know it, the stories are set at Craig Lockhart, or the novels are set at Craig Lockhart, which is a real hospital in Scotland, and at the end of the First World War, or during the First World War, and these officers are being treated for shell shock. And the officers among them are Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen, who were great, went on to be short-lived but extraordinary.
Robert Graves plays a small role. You know,
poets
role.
And Robert Graves plays a short role. And then the psychiatrist who's attending them was a real man also, who was W.H.R. Rivers. And then there are other fictionalized characters who are in that mix as well. And so she takes this hospital and these shell-shocked men and their ambitions and ambivalence and their poetic leanings, and then Rivers doing his pioneering psychoanalytical work.
And he's the central figure, really, in a way, through the three books.
Right.
And she creates some characters.
Yeah.
Billy Pryor is probably the most central through the first three books. He's a working class.
Right, addition to it,
But of course, he's an officer, too, because only officers are treated at Craig Lockhart.
Right, right.
But he offers this, and his sexuality is not fixed,
mm-hmm.
and his whole sense of social strata is not fixed, and he has a very different view. I mean, one of the things that struck me and still strikes me is the way that the things she emphasizes, there's a repetition. Like if you read the three books, you keep coming back
mm-hmm.
to the same places again and again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you start here
and end.
And 4 years later.
Sure.
I mean, yes, The Ghost Road ends just before the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that moment when Wilfred Owen's company is trying to cross the canal, and after all that, he's killed.
Yeah.
But really, if you track the three books as a reader, you're going there and coming back, and you're seeing these same places and these same experiences and these same words over and over and over again. And it begins to, inflict almost on you.
This war of attrition.
Yes, the same sense of, helpless awareness that you are in this, this circle that you can't get out of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done in a way that she has a little like Hilary Mantel. I mean, she has quite defined notions of what she's able to do and what she's not allowed to mm-hmm. do as a writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mansell is the most stringent mm-hmm. in terms of how she goes about that. Mm. I'm less stringent, right. I would say, than Barker.
What rules do you apply? That she doesn't or that she does?
I mean, I'm more willing to make up certain things in the middle.
Right.
I want to follow the trough that I've set.
Sure.
In this case, it's been two lives mostly, but
right.
things change. I don't mind inventing characters who didn't exist. I mean, she does that too, but I'm happy for a reader to read the book and not be able to track the scenes.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I love doing research as a novelist, but it's very much the Hippocratic form. First, do no harm, right? So
right, sure.
There's a contract you have with the reader, which
sure.
is to say, I'm not going to delude you
sure.
about what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
We're not, if I present this as something that's real history, I'm not going to go completely away from that.
Right.
But within that, the details of the characters you make, you are understanding that these are fictional
these
characters
are
by
yeah.
definition.
Sure.
My version of this person is already a fiction.
Right.
And after that, you're trying to get at some other truth
mm-hmm.
that's not just the biography. So, but in her case, I think she was one of the bravest writers to tackle this subject and to find in Rivers a character who himself is haunted by his experiences in the Solomon Islands before,
right.
but also by the fact that he's not on the front.
Mm-hmm.
But then you add to that the reality that he actually is not a pacifist. He
mm-hmm.
believes the war should be fought to the
sure.
end. You know, and yet he's caring for these people who come in,
mm.
and he's overseeing all of these electric shock treatments.
Mm.
And there's a kind of totality to the vision, and that's where the three books come in,
right.
which is, and that's part of the repetition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we all have this instinct in art to clean up, right? Both aesthetically and otherwise. But the patterning of things, sometimes relentless as it may be, is part of what happens.
Sure.
And part of how we read things afterwards and why things were important.
Right.
And these books do that. I think they have a real presence that's not aesthetic so much as it really is. It's another one of those books that get down in you at the level of being.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
there are writers who are more stylish.
Sure. No, but she's not one. I mean, let's also not neglect the fact that Pat Barker is a woman from the North.
Right.
Who had previously written, you know, pretty stark, feminist is maybe too strong, but a bold, unapologetic style
mm-hmm.
of her own about Northern women who then embarked on this extraordinary
She wanted
trilogy.
To break the mold for so she felt she
did. She felt she was being
yeah.
completely pigeonholed by it. She also wrote somewhere that the male point of view made her feel that she was wearing asbestos gloves and allowed
mm-hmm.
her to handle things that were otherwise too difficult to
He's
handle,
good.
Which I thought was a really interesting
And
analogy.
Actually, I mean, you can see her doing that all over the place.
Totally. And I think it's funny. I really want to read... I think it's called Life Class.
Yes.
That's the one
I haven't read.
I haven't read it either. And I it's one I have bookmarked. But anyway, I think she's a really interesting writer. And I'm always compelled by women like Hilary Mantel who choose this austere male perspective from which to write. It feels...
Yeah. I mean, Wolf Hall's worth a whole conversation.
It's a whole nother podcast in itself.
Yeah.
Both those books. I can't wait for the...
And actually, her memoir, Giving Up the Ghost... Fantastic. I mean,
I know, I've had that recommended too.
There's so many. She's
a curious
yeah,
lady.
She really is.
I want to make sure we've got time for
yeah.
everything. So the next book, help me with this one. So in order that you gave them to me, it Seize the Day, Saul Bellow,
right.
1956.
The novella, really. Is
Full
really short. Yeah.
Disclaimer. I have tried.
You hate it.
I know. I don't hate it. I've tried, I'm going to say five or six
mm-hmm.
times to climb into this and Humboldt's Gift
right.
and Herzog.
You,
am I just too white,
no,
too English, too not Jewish? What is the problem?
I would say too not Jewish.
What is?
I'm only half Jewish, but I would say that 70% of the women I like the most
uh-huh.
cannot stand Bella.
It's not
yeah.
standing. It's just I can't.
But they just they have. They,
I can't get inside
feels
it.
That they
I
have
can't.
No connection with
right.
him whatsoever.
Tell me why it's formative.
Well,
for you.
I started. I mean, I'll get to Seize Day in a moment, which
Sorry,
I actually
go.
Didn't. I didn't read it first. I started out. Again, I think this is during the Paris days, but I mean, I started with Augie March
mm-hmm.
and then I read Humboldt's Gift and then I read Herzog, which I ended up reading a couple of times. I don't know. I mean, maybe those were the main ones. And then I read Seize the Day. And now the thing about Bello again, and I don't want to go back and read most of them again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really don't. I sort of feel like, in a way, that's over. Mm-hmm. Seize the Day to me is sort of the perfect, it's the perfect dose of Bello. And I think it's the book that sort of is in between his couple of early novels, The Victim, Dangling Man, where he was still writing more in a kind of European style. They mm-hmm. were tighter, sparer. Mm-hmm. And then Augie March was the big, you know, I trumpet America, mm-hmm. and he's going to just go and grab it mm-hmm. and use the language and the idiom right. and the sort of messy, you know, circus of mm-hmm. it to the utmost. To me, you know, he's a kind of brain fever mm-hmm. as a writer. And I always was very wary of reading him while I was writing something.
Oh, interesting.
You know, in a particular uh-huh. vein, because I mean, I could never write like that. I never would.
But no, but it's
get into
too
your
consuming.
Head.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
the voice is so absolutely, it's so alive.
Sure.
And Seize the Day to me, the thing that got me, it's about a guy named Tommy Wilhelm, who is, you know, his name is not Tommy Wilhelm. His name is something, it's a sort of Jewish, unassuming name right. that it's sort of schlubby, but he wants to be Tommy Wilhelm. And so he renames himself Tommy Wilhelm. He's divorced, kids, alimony payments, he's poor, he's, you know, his work is falling apart. He needs $15,000, and it's basically a day, mm-hmm. more or less. He's got a psychiatrist, a therapist, mm-hmm. and who he sees, who becomes a character in this. And he's living in a kind of boarding hotel mm-hmm. up on the Upper West Side. And he's got a relationship with his father that is very problematic. All his relationships are problematic. Mm-hmm. But you can see him as a sort of Jay Gatsby kind of figure. Jay Gatz, who becomes Jay Gatsby, right?
Sure.
He wants to be this man. But the whole kind of soup bowl of American, of the American ideals, the mm-hmm. story of what that American
sure.
life is, it's kind of what he feels he's
right.
still engaged in, although he knows he's losing. So it's a big kind of con in a way, but it's done with incredibly con on himself, mm-hmm. trying to perpetuate himself forward into this sort of little mythic moment of mm-hmm. ambition. But at the same time, he cares. Like
yeah.
he is a lonely man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to ruin it for anybody. At the same time, it's impossible to talk about it and possible to talk about why it's a formative book for me without talking about where it ends up.
Right. He falls apart at the funeral.
Yeah, he's walking
right?
along Broadway. He's fallen completely apart, but he hasn't gotten quite there yet.
Hmm.
I mean, he's fallen apart, but
right.
there's still a little
there's
bit
a little
more
bit more to go.
And there's a crowd, and he steps, he feels disoriented and he needs to get out of the sun. He steps into this temple, or it's a church, I can't remember whether it's a church or a temple, and he finds himself in the midst of someone else's funeral, someone he doesn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
And in this crowd, grieving for this stranger, he loses it.
Mm-hmm.
Like he feels himself surrounded by and attending to mm-hmm. this other person. And it all happens in a sort of rolling moment,
mm-hmm.
you know, where his own circus sort of rolls over him.
Sure.
And he feels himself both stripped completely naked and at the same time, you know, there and,
right.
and full for just a moment.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I know. I'm not sure you should. I really get it. I hear it all the time, and I'm, you know, and I don't know. Question is how is Bello aging?
Right.
In a way, the work.
Right.
I mean, we know Martin Amis loves him.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't gone back.
When did you last read it?
I read that book probably 15 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. I have a thing for perfect short novels.
Mm. Disgrace, I don't know if it counts as a short novel. Disgrace by J.M. Kurtzer, published in 1999. I was so glad to see this on the list. It mm. was actually, it came up in the last podcast as someone's honorable mention, if you
mm-hmm.
like. I thought this was an astonishing book when this came out.
It is.
I thought it was wonderful. I was really glad to hear what you had to say and why this was one. When did you read it? When it came out?
I read
out
it when
later?
It came out,
mm-hmm.
and then I read it again a few years later, and then I was writing a talk about literature, and which is you know, an occasion really to sort of where you reach for your formatives.
Sure.
And it not only did it make it in, but I actually ended the talk by reading that last page.
Oh, really?
Of that book.
Mm-hmm. Why formative for you? What?
I think it was something about, look, he's been an extraordinary writer for a long time, and I read Waiting for the Barbarians a couple of times, and I read Life and Times of Michael Kay, and it's about Dostoevsky. But I felt that this book was his mature, in fact, I sort of feel like it was the high point of the mature before it began, before the weight of the Nobel maybe, and his own interest in theory and academia began. You know, he's been playing with form ever since, in his own autobiography, which he'd written in the third person.
Oh, wow.
And in his writing about, like, the lives of animals. Mm. He's very strong views about animal rights.
Mm.
And he's worked a lot of his theories into, you know, Elizabeth Costello, into the characters. But somehow Disgrace, it was a book that seemed to get it exactly right. So it's about, I mean, David Lurie is a 52-year-old professor of communications at the University of Cape Town. But you know, they have basically, in the new era of university education, they've done away with all modern language study. So he's left down to just one course on the romance, on, you know, romance writers, and that's it, in terms of what he considers to be culture. Mm. So he's kind of going through the motions. He's writing an opera about Byron, and he sees himself a little bit as Byron as too. He's good looking. He's very interested in sex, particularly with sort of exotic women. So there's a woman of color who is a prostitute who he sees until she suddenly cuts off their visits. He sees her regularly, and she, or the idea of her, means more to him than at first than he thinks.
Mm.
And then there's a pretty young student, right, Melanie, who he sleeps with a few times. And in each case, he does describe, you know, her as being more or less inert. And
I have the passage here. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
The young woman remains passive, and then the quote begins, as though she had decided to go slack, die within herself for the duration, like a rabbit when the jaws of the fox close on its neck, so that everything done to her might be done, as it were, far away.
Mm-hmm.
Which I felt was just, I was intrigued by it. When I saw it on your list and was rereading around the book and reminding myself of when I read it and thinking about, you know, so just to praise you quickly, this act gets him kicked out of the university, and then he goes to stay with his daughter. And then
he goes from, I think, Western to Eastern Cape Town, which is quite the move, you know, and he ends up down in the old country, right, where she's living on a sort of subsistence farming on this little bit of land. She is everything he's not.
Right.
She is unattractive, you know, sort of heavyset, doesn't care about her appearance. She's a lesbian.
Mm.
And she's living on this farm, and there's this black man, Petrus, who works the land, but also is building his own little bit by bit landed sort of existence.
Yeah.
Nearby. And so he enters into this world, to the idea that he will write his opera and live this way. And he likes, when he helps out Petrus sometimes with work, something that he sort of pleases him to think that this reversal, but he's aware of it, right? Mm. He's always sort of aware. And then he helps out because his daughter also works, has a kennel where she and this woman, Bev Shaw, work with these dogs. And that's, you know, that leads into the sort of second half of the novel where he's there, and then three men or boys and men come and they rape her.
His daughter.
And, yes, they rape his daughter and they light him on fire.
Yeah.
And they both survive. And then you're in a place where one of the boys is living with Petrus, the little boy. But rather than report him, Lucy continues. She feels, she decides to stay without reporting, even though it seems likely there'll be another attack. And they argue about this, and the father and the daughter are getting further apart. And it is not so much the events as it is it's the passage through these states of unlearning and knowledge in a way, and towards some kind of human feeling.
Mm.
And in his case, it brings us toward the end where he begins working. He's now disfigured. He survived this burning. He's no longer handsome or Byronic. He knows he's never going to finish his opera. He begins working at the animal shelter and the job that they do there. He almost forces himself to have a sexual relationship with Bev Shaw, who he describes as being like almost painfully unattractive, someone he's not attracted to.
Mm.
And their job is to put down the sick and the homeless animals. And there's one crippled dog that he becomes attached to, very attached. And the very end of this book, and we don't have it here, but if you have any time on this, when you get home, I hope you would read it.
Mm.
This last page, when he finally brings himself to put down this dog.
Mm.
And to me, that was the, I'm getting emotional just thinking about it, actually. The book has all of the theoretical, political, and philosophical issues that Coetzee has been dealing with, his whole life. And he has a very chiseled, cool intellect.
Mm.
And everybody knows this about him. And even personally, in his own life, he's that way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about this book that allowed him, the structure and the conjoining of these issues was simple. So it allowed him to inhabit it and touched on all those things. But it was simple enough that it allowed the human beings to grow as they would.
Mm.
The father and daughter, it's a family story, really. But all of the other issues and the complexities. And it has a profound depth to it. I mean, I think the recognition of between him and these animals and this dog at the end.
I think that to me was what I was so moved by in it. And your retelling of it too, that it's a book, to me, it's a book about shame. And the corrective to shame being this discovery of our common humanity, and by that I extend it to the animals, that he has to work, that he chooses to work with the maimed, the disfigured, the crippled dog, that he then must, that becomes the only palliative there is for what he and his daughter have endured, and also what they've inflicted on others. I mean, that little passage that I read about the rabbit going slack in the jaws of the fox. I was really struck by it, rereading it in this current day and age,
I wanted to get to that in a second. Yes.
Era. I'm really like, golly, I wonder what it is to, I would like, makes me want to reread the book now and see what I make of it, whether I
think it really stands up. I was thinking about it today because obviously everything we read right now is in this revision. Does it stand up to the standards that we are asking it to stand up to?
Yes, now, I don't need it to do that.
I don't need it to do that either.
At all.
But he was, and he's a difficult man. I mean, Coetzee and some of his views are difficult. He's never trying to please anybody.
Sure.
But actually, I think he gets it. I think he gets right at it without letting it take over.
Right.
And I that's the one thing you want to say to everybody else right now, too. There's still, the other stories go on.
Yes,
And in the end, they're never going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take your eye off it completely and think you're answering it with some prescriptive notion about how to correct things that are indeed wrong, you're missing the basic fundamental, issues that are going to be there one way or the other.
Right.
And it has to do with how we are with each other. And in the end, letting go of so many of our biases and blindnesses and arrogance, and levels of arrogance towards others, to understand that, in fact, we are all, at some level, we're all that dog.
We're all crippled dogs.
Yes.
Exactly, yeah.
And we need someone to have tenderness for us.
Right.
So I think he gets that. You never forget. You never let him off the hook, and he never fully apologizes.
No.
And that's why he's kicked out.
Right.
He apologizes, but he doesn't really apologize because he doesn't think he ought to.
Yeah.
And, I look back at The Good Soldier, where, I mean, how does that stand up? Edward Ashburnham he may even have raped this one woman. And, if you look at it in slightly different language, and he's constantly womanizing and picking up
young
all these people.
And
right.
All of it, yeah.
And he's the good soldier. But by simply casting doubt on those adjectives, you already are doing something that actually says more about how we have to figure this out than any number of easy prescriptions.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think, look, the power of literature, great fiction, is, you know, is and has always been it, to see the world through another's eyes,
yeah,
other people's eyes,
mm-hmm,
and to understand that no experience is simple and no experience is exactly what it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And no adjective you might throw upon that person says it all.
Right.
And that, you know, the stories are made up in exactly these gray areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we don't accept that in each other, then, you know, what are we going to do about ourselves?
Then, what hope is that? Yeah.
John, thank you. It's so fascinating.
Thanks.
I have a couple of rapid fire questions.
Yes.
I'm going to fire two at
all right.
you. What's the book you lie about having read?
I think it's Ulysses.
Ulysses.
I
mean, that's come up a few times.
It's not even Finnegan's Wake. I would never say I read Finnegan's Wake.
No.
But I never finished Ulysses.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
No bad.
Or I would say I skipped ahead to Yes.
Oh, okay. There we
Molly,
go.
Molly Bloom. Yes.
And you get to take one book to your desert island. What is it? It can be one of these five, or it can be another one.
I mean, I'm tempted to say Anna Karenina, but I mean, those books, you know, War and Peace and that. I mean, it has everything in it, and it feels more like the life that you will be missing.
Yes.
Than anything else.
It's a lovely way of looking at it. Yeah.
So I would say most likely that.
Okay.
I've read them both twice.
Yeah.
With years. Those are the great rereaders.
Isn't
right?
it?
Yeah.
How funny. We talked about this last
yeah.
season because I'd just finished rereading Anna Karenina for
yeah.
a second time, and I talked about a bit of what it was to stumble on those people for
yeah.
a second time. Yeah.
Well, you definitely don't want to take Seize the Day or something.
You take Seize
yeah,
the Day.
Okay.
John, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
It was such a pleasure.
Oh, it was fun.
Thank
I really
you.
Enjoyed it. I mean, I don't even get to do this that often, just sort of talk books, you know.
It's such a pleasure. It
yeah.
really is.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you like the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website, bookishwithsonyawalger.com, if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the five favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Walger page. You can find us on Twitter with @BookishSonia or @SoniaWalger.com. And you could also email me through the info@BookishWithSoniaWalger.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from, or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.